welcome to Life Matters this Easter weekend. Natasha Mitchell, very pleased to be with you this morning. Hope you've managed to have some time away somewhere lovely this weekend and the kids aren't rolling around in too much agony after too many chocolate Easter eggs. It's a good time, I think, to be fantasising about an even longer weekend, perhaps. How about a year? How about Paris? Writer Patty Miller found herself with an empty nest and heading off to France. She didn't just pack a guidebook. The whole pantheon of great French writers followed her there too. Delicious stuff. Also coming up, mush. Yep, mush. That's pretty much how it can feel inside your head after you've undergone cancer treatment. Chemo has lots of side effects we acknowledge. What about those we don't so much? Can we do anything about so-called chemo fog? Or chemo brain? Do you relate? Tweet us at RN Life Matters. First though, do you find it hard to talk about money with your partner? No go, taboo. Perhaps it always leads to arguments. Money disputes are one of the top causes of stress in relationships, of the breakdown of relationships. So how do you make the most of your money in good times and in bad? Good, of course, being the time when you're in love and the relationship's going well. Bad, of course, when your relationship falters, as one in three marriages sadly do, and then you might be heading for the divorce court if you're unlucky. And money then becomes a very ugly issue to have to negotiate over. Well-known financial advisor Paul Clitheroe has a new book on money, marriage and divorce. It's warts and all, very detailed. He joins me in the Life Matters studio. Welcome back to the program, Paul.
Thank you.
Why do we find it so hard to talk about money? I mean, not just in relationships, it's everywhere. We find it hard to be frank about this taboo subject.
Money is actually the last taboo subject in our society. When I grew up, I'm 60 this year. When I grew up in the country town of Griffith with my mum and dad, there were two taboo subject areas around the dinner table, sex and money. Now, what's fascinating is, having had three young children, now three young adults, and some of the questions they would ask at the dinner table will come to money. But, you know, the littlest at time would say, now, mummy, daddy, what's this safe sex thing? And, you know, mummy or daddy would sort of, you know, you'd grit your teeth. No, you can do that. You talk about, you know, diseases. And the 14 or 12-year-old will go, oh, that's disgusting. I don't want to talk about that. So funnily enough, we've kind of geared up to deal with sex, but money, we're still terrible. And then you come to relationships, and as you mentioned, significant failure rate in first marriages. And we shouldn't forget, by the way, there's actually only a 60% failure rate in second marriages. So what we do know is in all of the work done after people split up, whether it's de facto or marriage, whatever it may be, we do know that money is rarely the dominant cause of the split. Mm. I am leaving you because of money. It's usually, but money is always in the top two or three as the ongoing, as you articulated, the ongoing niggly stuff.
The undercurrent of tension.
And it is really interesting because, see, I'll give you this, what a behavioural psychologist would say is, well, you know, clearly what you should do is you should understand your money profile. And when you meet someone, you should ensure in the early stage of the relationship, you discuss and discover their money profile. And even though your money personalities, your money profile will be different, that's not going to happen.
No, it's not. And it's a very unromantic thing to talk about. So what you're encouraging here, and actually you move through every stage of a relationship, you're encouraging couples to talk about money very early on. How and what sorts of things should they be discussing?
The reason it's a taboo subject area is it's easy to avoid. You're probably thinking to yourself, whether you're female or male, it doesn't matter. You're probably thinking, gee, you know, I probably should have this conversation, but it's probably going to cause a fight. So the trick, I think, is to, one is observation. And I would like to think if you've been going out with someone for a while, you'll very quickly realise if they're a credit card payer offerer, they get their credit card cleared up, or in actual fact, they're always struggling with credit cards. I think you'll fairly quickly work out if in actual fact, maybe you're a younger person and maybe owning a home's important to you, maybe having holidays important to you. Some people will happily whack a holiday on a credit card. Another person may find that the most stressful holiday of their life. Mm. And I don't think you should be saying, now, listen, you, we need to sit down and document our future plans and dreams. Are we saving for a house? Are we not saving for a house? I think if you actually think about it without getting into arguments, I do think you'll actually know. If someone listening now, you think about your partner, I will be, even if you've been together for a year, I'll bet you actually know their money personality.
Right. So, and in fact, money personalities can be very different in a relationship. So in those initial stages, people might be inclined to collapse everything together, to, you know, have joint accounts, joint mortgages, the whole lot, share it all. What are the potential pitfalls there?
The two ways you can go here, and again, really talking about, I guess, more first relationships, that, and we're seeing with great fascination, all of the research that we did for this book showed us that many younger couples, and I can include my young adult children in this, particularly in the early stages, which these days are typically living together, are most certainly running separate accounts their pay is going into. And that, by the way, is accessible. But again, you see, here's your first money conversation. So we meet, we're happy, we decide to move in. We're both working. If that's the case, that's great. But we're going to have a conversation about, initially it might be, I'll tell you what, how about I pay the rent and you pay the food and going out to eat? And we kind of feel that's about even. If you're starting to get some tension around this evenness thing, it's a great time. Maybe you need a bottle of red to do it. But it actually is a great time to say, look, you know, I think I might be paying a bit more than you, for example. I mean, you know, you don't need to be aggressive in the subject matter. I know money causes fights. What I'm telling people, though, is what we tend to do is, because we know it may cause a fight, the natural human response is we stick our head in the sand and we avoid the conversation. Because what I'm telling you is, if you're with someone who's always got a credit card problem, can never have a holiday unless they whack it on a credit card, and there's always money drama, if you shut your eyes to that and you think it's going to get better, I promise you it is not going to get better.
So acknowledging, as you have, that people have very different money personalities, so to speak, there is a tendency in relationships for one person, perhaps, who's more inclined to do that stuff, to take it over. Now, what are the problems with that, with kind of divesting responsibilities altogether, or just checking in every now and then, but trusting them to be the keeper of the decisions?
It is a really challenging one, because on one hand, I think many relationships work extremely comfortable where in a trusted relationship, if one person is using specialist skills in one area, another person is doing specialist skills in another, that's actually really efficient.
So one person might be, say, tracking the household budget more closely, the other might be thinking about the long-term investments and managing those.
Oh, look, unfortunately, I wish it worked like that. It's more normally to the case that one person might be worried about getting the kids into the right school or kids' homework, and the reality is the bill paying may fall to another. No, so I know where you're going with this, and I agree with you completely, and after 30-odd years of talking to people about their money, the one I hate the most is and unfortunately, certainly in my generation, it often is a lady who'll come to me in her 50s seeking advice and will say, we're splitting up, I've got no idea. He has always done that.
And I know men who have been in that situation too. They handed over all the accounts, essentially, the processes, to their partner, their female partner.
And they're lost. Mm. And so the challenge we have here is that what I would argue is that a money skill inside a relationship is that a money skill is actually not something, this is not the 1940s or 50s where you went through life and if you manage, basically you'd go through life, you'd pay off a house, you'd have a savings account, no super in those days, you'd end up with a house, a bit of money in the bank, and you retire on the age pension at 65, and you were living probably 15 years shorter than we are today. So what I'm saying is that money conversations, and the point you're making, which I agree with wholeheartedly, whether you're in a relationship or not in a relationship, every Australian needs money skills. And inside every relationship, you actually need to understand, and not being interested is not an excuse. What I get a bit fretful about, though, is if you start to inquire of your partner about money and your partner starts pushing you away, that's a very challenging negotiation situation.
It is. So
you're
start
trying to express
interest.
Start with it.
Do it early. What about sexually transmitted debt?
That's not a shocking name.
Describe what it can be and what a mess it can create in someone's life when the relationship is on the rocks.
It's just awful, unfortunately. And again, this is equally male and female, by the way. It's not a gender issue. But on either side, if your partner has poor financial habits that you're not discussing, the split up comes along, you might think, oh, we own a house with a mortgage and, you know, there's a bit of a business. And all of a sudden you actually find the car is actually leased. the house is fully mortgaged, the business is going broke, there's actually $70,000 or $80,000 in credit card debt, which I see very often, by the way. Literally $70,000, $80,000 in unknown credit card debt to the relationship. And then you might find that it might be a joint card. And all of a sudden, the split up happens. You might find that the house that you think is going to be your future security is geared to the hilt. Mm. The business that looked like it had good cash flow doesn't. And so, you know, you can literally, you can find yourself on where maybe you've signed some documents that your partner, male or female, put in front of you one night. It's late at night. The kids are not sleeping. Please sign this, will you, darling? It's to do with, you know, just sign it. It's for tax or whatever. All of a sudden, you find you're guaranteed a loan against your home. So you actually become a co-owner of a piece of credit card debt. The other half goes away. You're left with sexually transmitted debt. You're left with debt that you probably didn't even know about. And when you go to the bank and say, what's all this about? The bank says, well, look, we don't like this either, but here's your signature, here's your approvals. Sexually transmitted debt, it's probably the worst of all because it's just a complete shock.
And it's a betrayal of trust. Paul Clitheroe is with me this morning on Life Matters, author of Money, Marriage and Divorce. He's also chair of the Federal Government's Financial Literacy Board, which provides all sorts of information around how to build your financial literacy. And we're talking about, well, relationships and money, that taboo terrain. So the relationship goes totally astray. Divorce is on the card. And there are all sorts of myths and assumptions, aren't there, about where you'll be left?
Oh, look, totally. And the issue here is that, and ironically, by the way, there are three great stages of divorce, and one of them is called the Silvers, and that's me. I've been married to Vicky for 32 years, and funnily enough, we've kind of got through the seven-year itch period. We've got through the middle ages of maybe it's male menopause, I want a sports car, you know, all the stuff that goes on. We've got through all that and three growing up children and got the mortgage paid off. And funnily enough, this is the next big one. And this is exactly Vicky and myself, where the three kids leave home. Paul and Vicky look at each other and say, who are you?
But you're hanging together.
Oh, we're really happy.
Whereas a whole lot of people are the so-called silver separators, yep. And that has big money consequences.
It really does. So, and the issue here is that, again, it's easy to describe the perfect world. In the perfect world, I mean, you must have loved someone to have been with them at some point in time. I hardly expect you to love them if you're splitting up. So I understand, haven't been through it myself, but I understand there's going to be tension. We did lots of research, spoke to lots of people around this book. So basically, the challenge that you have now is, number one, is that how do you calm yourself about this process? And one of the things that I would strongly, and I strongly encourage in this book, is that in a sense, male or female can say, look, my lawyer or however you're doing this, if you can organise a negotiated settlement yourself, maybe with a bit of advice, that's great. But let's say it's going to be 50-50 because the kids have grown up. And I get a lot of people saying, but Paul, I get half the house and half the super and I've got this, but can I live? And that the tension about the split up, nearly, look, no, you can get a higher paid job than me. I need to get 60% of what we've got
assume that they might get half. The reality is quite different.
Oh, totally.
So just describe some of the really big challenges that people can confront, money challenges, as a divorce is negotiated.
The really big challenge is that what's going to happen, and particularly if you're in the legal system, which many people need to be, lawyers do a good job in this area if needed, expensive. Rule number one, by the way, is that if you get too antsy about, and I see divorces where people feel as though they must win. We've had one long-standing one that we've been trying to give some advice around unsuccessfully, where they're both determined to get 51%. Yeah, determined. Over $1 million has now been spent fighting over this issue. Over $1 million.
Why?
Well, the good news is the 51% doesn't matter a lot because there's not much left to fight about. And it's not the lawyer's fault, by the way. Both of these people are determined they must win at exit. I must be told that I was the winner. I got 51 or 55%. So the issue is, the first thing is it pays, even if you're not getting on very well, it pays to cooperate. The system will require you, if you go into the system, to come up with statements of assets and so on. So the rule number one is you've got to look what you've got. Rule number two is that if you can't work it out by yourself, and I do think some advice here is a good idea, because I do see, and again, particularly in my generation, at times it has been the female who's accepted a self-negotiated deal of 50-50, when in actual fact there are young kids one of the partners may be earning a lot more money, and the reality is the courts would probably be closer to 70-30 or whatever. So you need to be careful about what seems like a generous 55-45, because you need to put your own situation in. No one wants to fight about money.
And not all assets are equivalent.
Oh, look,
and people make all sorts of assumptions there.
Yep.
Do I give up their super and keep the house? Do I, you know, these things aren't all equivalent, and there are tax consequences too that you think people need to be well aware of.
Well, if you take the house with a mortgage and all of a sudden that mortgage is there to be paid off, you know, you may find out that the security you hoped it may bring may be a millstone around your neck. There are all sorts of rules in here, but basically what I do find really important is that if you are splitting up, it is actually worth getting, you know, go to a lawyer if you need to, it is worth getting a rough idea of what sort of percentage you might be likely to get. And then you can actually start to take a look at, well, if I am getting X dollars, can I afford to eat? Can I afford, will I be renting? Will I be buying a smaller apartment? What about the kids and so on? And so really what I do find is that if you can try and keep the bigger picture in your mind, but if you get to the point where you are arguing violently about Great Edna's Christmas green vase you got given, which no one really likes, but if you get involved in an emotional argument, I think you'll end up being certainly probably the loser emotionally and financially.
The house is an emotional object.
Yes.
Lots of baggage, emotional baggage, lots of meaning attached to it. And there's a very interesting case study in the book, one of many, of Sally, who they separate. Her ex-partner refuses to continue paying the mortgage, and she recognises the risk and keeps paying it. Now, what was the benefit of her doing that?
Well, the problem you have in these is, like Sally, is that the issue you have here is that unless you actually get things financially settled, don't forget, if you're killing yourself to stay in the house and pay the mortgage and you haven't had your financial settlement, basically you are still holding an asset on behalf of both of you. So he's refusing to pay in this case.
Until the divorce is negotiated.
Yeah, correct. So in other words, you could be funding your partner by hanging out of the house. But the other big one for me, though, is that when the crunch comes, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. And this really is tough love. And for me, one of the big challenges is that if you think, great, one half's got the super and I've got the house, well, I'd really encourage people to think about how are you going to fund the mortgage? What are your plans to pay for that mortgage? You may actually be better off going into a superannuation and house pot where those assets are split between you, where the house is sold, because often, don't forget, what a lot of this is about a fresh start.
Mm.
And we shouldn't be overly negative about this, you know, because while I think no one wants this to happen, we're getting close, you know, to half of all marriages will have this happen over the decades. What I'm saying is if you're having money conversations, I think you have a greater chance of relationship success is the big one for me. And if you've had money conversations on the way through, even if your relationship is not successful, I think you're in a position to make more logical money decisions when you break up.
This is terrifically useful. Thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters. Just to give us actually a flavour of the incredible amount of information in this book. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure.
Paul Clitheroe, financial advisor and author of Money, Marriage and Divorce, Making the Most of Your Assets in Good Times and Bad. It's published by Penguin. And actually, as someone who hasn't gone through a divorce, I actually found this extremely useful in terms of just basic financial literacy. So there you go. Natasha Mitchell with you this Easter Monday. Hope you're having a fantastic day. You're with ABC RN. This is Life Matters. Up next, we're ransacking Paris. An empty nest, a year in Paris. Writer Patty Miller and her partner decided to go and live the Parisian dream, not just to be tourists, mind you, but to breathe in deeply, to absorb the ideas, the history, the literature, which makes Paris so special. Patty's book of that special year is called Ransacking Paris, A Year with Montaigne and Friends. Her title is inspired by a quote from a man she adores, Montaigne. He's a 16th century French philosopher, And here's the quote. Bees ransack flowers here and flowers there, but then they make a honey which is entirely theirs. It's no longer thyme nor marjoram, honey. Paddy Miller joins us in the Life Matters studio. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Natasha. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you. A year in Paris. What special honey of your own were you hoping to make, walking in the footsteps of French writers and philosophers, as you do?
I think that I was hoping to find my relationship to that culture and to European culture generally, because I think I identify very strongly with the Australian landscape, but I always felt very drawn to European literature, and particularly French literature and French ideas. So a year in Paris, I think, was a way of finding my identity in relation to that place as well, because I didn't really know where I stood. And I realised after that year that probably, while my heart belongs here in Australia, and particularly in the Australian landscape, I think my mind probably belongs in Paris. That's just the way it has to be.
In fact, the Francophile impulse for you started way back, though, in the Australian landscape at the little school that you went to.
Yes.
One of eight kids growing up on a farm.
Yes. I think I went to a tiny little school out in central west New South Wales and enrolled in French and not sensibly in commerce like most of the rest of the class did. And I immediately fell in love with French, but also with the idea of, I think, of another language. It could have been any other language, perhaps, but a French teacher was available. And I think it was that idea of there being other names for things. It introduced the idea that there could be another way of thinking, another way of seeing. And part of French, learning French in those days, was that you were introduced to French culture as well. Mm-hmm. So I was introduced even to Montaigne all those years ago when I was a 14-year-old. And I can't remember what I made of it then, except that I was fascinated by the idea of a life of the mind.
Well, now you've mentioned Montaigne, let's use him to, in a sense, give people some shape to what you are trying to achieve with this book, which is you taking yourself to Paris as an empty nester, actually to write about a very dark experience in your life. We'll probably come to that.
Yes.
But you sit down and have these imaginary coffees with great thinkers, including Montaigne. So tell us about your connection to him and who he was.
Well, he was a, as you say, a 16th century writer, an essayist, really. People call him an essayist, but to me, he's actually a memoirist. He is the original memoirist, I think, in modern literature anyway, in that he takes on the self as a topic for literature, as a worthy topic for literature. And I found that really interesting, because these days in the literary community, memoir can be somewhat frowned upon as a self-indulgent, nasal-gazing exercise. And so I found it fascinating that he was defending the territory of memoir, that it was a worthy topic. In fact, he was very cheeky about it. At the beginning of his memoir, he says something like the topic of this book is myself, and I can't expect the reader to waste their time on something so vain and frivolous. So goodbye, dear reader. And I love his cheek, and I wish I had that sort of cheek. So I was drawn to him, I think, because he was defending the territory that I love. But also his awareness is so contemporary, his understanding that we construct the self all the time, that the self is not a given, that our ideas, our beliefs, our faith, our understanding of the world is all a construction. And that seems very postmodern to me, that he actually understood that idea.
And it was an interesting year in terms of your own self, because you were saying goodbye to your boys, your two sons.
That's right. I was at that classic stage. I suppose my youngest son had just left school. He'd turned 18 and finished his HSC.
And then mum leaves home.
And then I was out the door. I think he was very very astonished by the rapidity by which we lived. I think he was quite astonished. But I did manage to install him in a flat with his older brother to look out for him. So I felt that that would be okay. And then we were gone. But he actually also, after a while, he was doing international studies at the university, and the younger son managed to get a to study in Amsterdam.
And come
so
and join you.
Yeah, so that, well, for a little while, but there was a little bit of crossover. But it was really about a lot that year about letting go of that central role, I think, of looking after children.
Yeah. And interestingly, you also have a fictional coffee with Simone de Beauvoir. And there was an overlap in your life.
Yes.
She lived when you lived in the same century. And you felt an incredible connection to this woman,
yes,
despite your very different lives.
Yes.
But also radical differences too,
yes,
around the having of children, the writer's life with children, which you've probably had to wrestle with.
Yes, I found her fascinating. I mean, I adored her evocation of her childhood and her teenage years, and felt like I identified with her so closely. There were so many things that we were similar in. Even just little things like liking to sticky beak into other people's lives, like looking at other people all the time.
The magpie.
Yes, and looking out and where she lived, looking out into other people's apartments all the time. And I found that's one of the things I absolutely loved in Paris.
A voyeur.
But and even things like sexual fantasies. We had the same sexual fantasies, which I imagine came from our shared Catholicism. So we had that in common. But I was, you know, from a poor farming family in central West New South Wales. She was from a bourgeois family in Paris. So we were very different. But as she grew older, I found her attitudes to the having of children were the opposite of mine, really. It was something that I think was a different kind of life experience, in that she didn't have children, even though she adopted someone later on, but they were already adult when she adopted them. So it wasn't like she had experienced. But I don't think you have to experience bringing up children to understand it. Plenty of people do that in their...
And we were all children once.
Yes, in their insight and their imagination. So her attitude to children was pretty much that women really ought not be allowed to have them. Mm-hmm. And I found that something that I couldn't really relate to. But it wasn't enough for me not to keep loving her. I just had to forgive her.
And coming back to your core love of Montaigne and you sitting down with him, I mean, he had a great influence on contemporary psychology, I gather. His writing about the self,
yes,
kind of fueled that.
Well, I think everyone read Montaigne. All the other memoirists that I read, including Rousseau and de Beauvoir, everybody, Stendhal, they all read Montaigne and they all loved Montaigne, and I think it's his insight into the inner self, but also his insight and awareness of the public world as well.
And he's writing about sex, death and pain, and these were all themes you were grappling with in your own life in that year in Paris.
Exactly, yes.
You were also trying to write the story of something very intimate to you.
Yes.
That had happened 10 years before.
Yes, it's the death of a friend, the young death of a friend. She was only 37, going on 38 when she died, and she'd left a three-year-old child who became another child for me. I looked after him.
This is Theo.
Theo, yes. I looked after him for about 3 days every week for about 6 or 7 years, and then his father moved away and he came on for holiday. So he's sort of like my access child in a way. So,
what was the story you wanted to tell there in Paris?
I wanted to tell the story of his mother's, my relationship with his mother, who I'd only known 3 or 4 years before she died, but also my relationship with him, which became a very close and intimate one. And he's 25 now, and he's still part of my life. He still comes up and visits me. I visit him in Melbourne. So Theo's still an important part of my life. But I was wanting to understand mortality in many ways. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the themes that brought me very close to Montaigne, because that was something that he wrote about a lot. One of his very early essays is about death.
And ageing. And and that, yes, in fact the slow death,
yes,
that you might think ageing represents,
yes,
is, yes, probably harsher,
yes,
than the finality of absolute death.
That's what he argued, and he said that he found that much harder to bear. He said to understand death was to understand life, and he said that's something that we need to be able to do, and he found it much more difficult to get older than to face the idea of death, and I think that's quite true. And that's, you know, I was going through a transition in my sexuality at that time as well in Paris, because I was going through menopause, so it was a letting go of something that had been a central part of me as well, which is the physical fruitfulness.
Were you feeling feeling that as a death of sorts, were you?
I was feeling it.
Because you do say that, in you talk, yes, about the two deaths,
yes,
that you were grappling with, the death of your friend.
Yes.
The death of your sexuality, and I was really,
yes,
it stood out for me, actually.
Yes, yes, it wasn't really a death of sexuality. There was a flux going on, and fortunately I came out the other side of it with sexuality intact, but it was that feeling that a central part of you could be lost, and who were you after that? That was part of what I was looking at. But it was also letting go forever of physical fruitfulness. That kind of has gone completely. But it was also that it's a central part of the way that we see ourselves, is that we are sexual beings as well. We're intellectual beings. We're physical. We're psychological beings, we're emotional beings, but we're also sexual beings, and it's part of who we are.
Absolutely. Patty Miller is with us this morning, author of Ransacking Paris, A Year with Montaigne and Friends, and this Easter Monday we're talking about a year that she spent in Paris really sitting down and having imaginary cups of coffee with a whole stack of the pantheon of Paris's wonderful thinkers.
Yes.
You also, though, joined a choir.
I did. And that was one of those things that I had been in a choir. I was living in the Blue Mountains at that stage. I live in King's Cross now, but I was living in the Blue Mountains for more than 20 years, and I had learned to sing, and that was part of the book about Theo too, was about learning to sing, and I think I was very interested in the idea of transformation, the way that we can be transformed by all sorts of things, by the way our body changes, but also by singing, by writing. And so I thought when I got to Paris, I'd join a choir as a way of being able to keep on singing, but it was also a way of becoming part of the community, because I didn't want to just be outside the community looking at it, observing it. I wanted to be part of it. So I joined a choir in the 20th arrondissement. It was just a little local choir, a centre d'animation, which is like the community college course, and I'd go there every Thursday night.
And they played with your name, I think.
They did. They called me, their pronunciation of it was partir, which is to leave. So they called me Parti d'Australie, which I thought was leaving from Australia. And they would also consult with me when we did learn some songs in English, Mercedes-Benz, the Janis Joplin song.
Oh.
But because I was singing with them, I ended up singing it with a French accent.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've actually been pulled back and back and back every year now to teach memoir workshops.
Yes, yes.
To Paris.
Yes, I go back every year for a couple of months now, and I usually do some walking in France, because I've become a great walker as well, walking long distances, but also to teach the memoir class to other writers who maybe have had the same dream as I had of being a writer in Paris. So they can come and live in an apartment in Paris and do the writing each day and participate, I guess, in that dream of being a writer in Paris, because it is it sounds fantastical, but it's actually very real as well. I think that kind of encouragement and support that you feel as a writer in Paris. I remember when I went in to buy a SIM card in the telephone shop, and they had to take your name and your details, and I said, Patty Miller, and he said, Comme Henri, meaning like Henry Miller, and I said, oui, and then I said, il est mon oncle, he's my uncle, and we both laughed. And I thought, I don't think if I went into a telephone shop in Australia, I would get a literary reference from the telephone guy.
You so would not. Look, it's a great thing to ransack a little bit of your life in Paris, as you ransacked Paris. Always ransacking. It's kind of the memoirist's way, isn't it?
It is. I think we do. We ransack life and literature and everybody else too, I suppose.
Thank you so much for joining us this Easter Monday on Life Matters.
Thanks, Natasha.
Patty Miller. Oh, we didn't even get to Rousseau on nature. You'll have to check it out. And the book, Ransacking Paris, A Year with Montaigne and Friends, is published by University of Queensland Press. Well, Life Matters is where you are. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning on Easter Monday. Oh, I'm feeling a little foggy. Well, certainly there's one experience that makes a lot of people feel very foggy, but there seems to be something you might be able to do about it. That's coming up next. If you've had it, you'll know this. Chemo. One word. Yuck. It's one of the main weapons, of course, we have against cancer. Unfortunately, it affects normal cells as well as cancer cells. As a result, much more of our bodies than the actual cancer cells cop it when we have the therapy. Nausea, hair loss. These are the side effects we can feel and see. Then there's a side effect that you can't see, and that's the effect of chemotherapy on our brain. Chemo fog. Have you heard of it? Have you had the experience? Or chemo brain is how some people describe that feeling of distinct mental wooliness that can consume us during cancer treatment. There's some debate about whether it has a biological basis, whether chemo actually causes this feeling. But psychologist Heather Green designs workshops to help people handle the cognitive impacts of cancer treatment. And she joined us in the Life Matters studio a little earlier, in the Gold Coast studios, in fact, along with one of her workshop participants, Faye Schultz.
Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Natasha.
Faye, let's start with your experience. You were diagnosed with breast cancer 5 years ago, and you've done Heather's workshops. Let's just get a sense, though, of what the interior experience is of undergoing chemo. This foggy brain that some people talk about. What was it like for you?
Yes, you do get a very foggy brain. You get fuzzy brain. Nothing, you can't follow through thoughts. You forget a lot of things. You get very stressed over trying to remember things, and you feel it's just your own brain. But it seemed to be a lot more magnified after having chemo. So,
and you were a company director while you were going through all this. So, how'd your brain go on the job?
Very poorly. I found my ability to last a day just didn't happen. I just would wear out very quickly. So I had trouble with it, yes.
Tell us about what particular tasks you were, you know, what do you remember was happening mid-task?
In concentration, I just lose my concentration. I did a lot of computer work, and halfway through a job, I just didn't want to continue. I'd want to walk away from it.
Because you couldn't mentally engage with what you were doing?
Yes, I just lose track, and just my brain just no longer wanted to handle it. Just didn't want to handle it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether this was just with those more tricky tasks at work that require real focus, but what about everyday tasks like shopping and cleaning and cooking and all that stuff?
Yes, you could get through most of the daily things, but after a period you just hit a wall and just couldn't cope with any of those either. Had to really try and focus on just getting through the day sometimes. Some days you didn't, you just sort of did nothing.
And the thing is, I mean, sometimes people say, well, this is the stress of the cancer, the anxiety of the diagnosis, of the treatment, or it might just be ageing. Not to be indelicate, but you were 62.
Yeah, well, that's right. I felt like it sped up everything. I mean, you do have a certain amount of inabilities as you get older, they slow down and everything, but it felt like instead of just being a normal progression, it sped up and all of a sudden I wasn't capable of doing things that I normally was.
Your daughter actually has had breast cancer too, hasn't she? Did she go through the same sort of chemo fog experience that people talk about, that you're describing?
Yes, she did, very much so. She is a teacher, and she was quite, it stressed her quite badly, the fact that she couldn't remember things or finish tasks off or work on a computer or do different things. It became quite stressful for her.
Heather, you've set up these workshops. You're a psychologist, so people's mental function is of vital interest to you. There is some debate, isn't there, about whether chemotherapy does affect the brain in a really tangible way. What do people tell you about this experience that Faye is alluding to?
Faye's experience tallies with what a lot of other people have. So things like being able to maintain your concentration, or that sense of hitting a wall, and the feeling that it's the more complex demands that tend to be most vulnerable are some experiences that many people report. And some of the things that people talk to me about that also let me know something out of the ordinary is going on is how they have to change their everyday behaviour to fit in with things. So people who normally used to feel quite confident with getting around might now go out and actually carry a street directory in our pre-smartphone times, or take somebody with them because they're no longer confident of their sense of direction. So those sorts of changes suggest to me that that's more than just stress.
Although there is debate about that, isn't there, that whether or not it's chemo that's at work here. Have there been, I know I've done some really interesting interviews on animal studies and the impact of chemo on the cells of the nervous system, and in those studies, the impact, it seemed, early days, was quite dramatic. I mean, cells were being killed off in preference to cancer cells. But has there been any effort to study this objectively in humans?
Yes, well, some of the research in humans that can help give us more of an insight is some of the neuroimaging work, for example. So we can see that in some cases people might actually be able to do just as well with their brain functions as previously, but we can see from things like MRI or PET imaging that their brains are actually working harder to maintain that same level of performance. So again, that suggests that there is a biological basis for at least some of what's going on.
You're interested in the psychology of what's going on.
Yes, but it is important to understand too, if we thought this was something that was completely a psychological phenomenon, we might approach it in a somewhat different way. But my colleagues who work in the more biologically based areas do seem to be accumulating more evidence. So as you say, from the animal studies and also from things like imaging and other sorts of work that makes us understand a little better about mechanisms.
Yeah, well, I mean, chemotherapy is it's a tough toxin to have in your body. You know, you'd have to think that it also affects your brain. So what did you want to do with your workshop? So you work with people like Faye who have survived cancer. It's after their treatment.
That's right. So we work with people who finished treatments at least 6 months ago, and that's because our brains are actually very good at recovering. So we want to have some chance for things to have had their natural recovery processes, and then seeing if we can add on to that as well to perhaps help people along the path. And as a psychologist, I like to work with people in ways that they can learn things that they can continue to apply in their everyday life. So we have a focus on learning how to understand your brain and how to get more out of your brain. And what we talk about in these workshops, we talk a lot about the fact that actually all of us could be doing more with our brains.
Yep.
So we're not doing...
Agreed with you there. Are you getting them all to do Sudoku or Sudoku?
That's a very good question, Natasha. We do talk about Sudoku and crossword puzzles and things, but I'm not a fan of specific brain training in that sense. We talk about how some more holistic and integrated things, and also things that take into account the importance of your physical health, can make a difference to your brain health.
Well, let's talk through some of the things that you do with participants. So they come to you for 4 2-hour sessions. What do you do? What do they do?
So we spend a lot of time discussing in the group. So we want to know what the experience has been like for the participants themselves and ideas that they want to share with each other. We talk about what we do know about cancer and aging and the brain, so what might be going on. And we look at various sorts of strategies and ways that people can use to deal with these problems.
Okay, what are some of the strategies?
So the two main things that you can do, two main types of strategies, are things that will compensate for a change in your function. So things like using a diary or a smartphone or a calendar to have reminders or lists or things like that can help to compensate if, for example, your memory isn't working as well as before.
Mm.
And then the other set of strategies are more skills-based, of more directly learning some memory strategies like imagery, for example, or putting things together in a way that works with the brain, way your brain naturally likes to remember things. We're much better at remembering by the first letters of words, for example. So you might rearrange your shopping list so that everything starts with the same letter.
That's great. Extra effort, but sometimes that's what's required when you know you're having a struggle.
Yes, and some of the best strategies we find are things that participants suggest to each other. And that's where a lot of the benefit of these groups comes, from sharing those ideas. So with my co-facilitators, my fantastic doctoral students who've helped develop and been an integral part of this research, often we get to a point where we're just sitting back and guiding the conversation because the ideas are just flowing.
On Life Matters this morning, we're talking about that experience of chemo brain, or chemo fog as some people describe it, that kind of mental wooliness that you can get after chemotherapy. Heather Green, a psychologist at Griffith University, is doing workshops with people who have had cancer treatment to help them improve their cognitive function. And Faye Schultz is with us too. She's a survivor of breast cancer and she is a participant in these workshops. Faye, tell us about your experience of the workshop and whether it made a difference to you.
Yes, the workshop I found very good. I never seemed to be able to complete a task. I'd start on something and was quite befuddled most of the time. And of course, what happens is you get stressed over it and then it gets worse. So you never seem to end up doing to the end of any task. And one of the ones I found good was a goal planning, where you break it down to one task that you want to accomplish and break it right down to times of day to do it, thinking it through, where you're going to do it, how you're going to do it, and writing it all down and planning an end so that you got to the end of it at some stage, and then giving yourself a massage or something at the end.
I like the sound of
that. A nice reward at the end so that you got the idea that you could work through something to the end.
And part of this is also rebuilding your confidence, I would imagine, after...
Well, it is. Yeah.
...chemotherapy and a breast cancer diagnosis.
That's right.
Mm.
And another one I found good was the listing everything. I list everything now. And if I'm going out for the day, I list what I might want to accomplish and what I have to accomplish. And I find I get through most of it. Whereas before, I'd go out and come home and say, oh, I've forgotten this, I've forgotten that, and then be quite stressed over it and have to go again or whatever.
How much, Faye, was this also about learning how to manage stress and being able to share that experience with other people to help just release yourself from the stress and anxiety of dealing with cancer?
Well, that's right. I think it builds up, and the more you're stressed, the worse you seem to get. And relieving all that allows you to think through things a lot better, be a lot clearer, more focused.
How are you now?
Oh, quite good, yes. I still have my lists 2 years later, but I know I can do that, and I know I could work through something I want to do and plan it, and I have strategies now that work a lot better.
And Heather Green, who's hosting these workshops for people who have gone through cancer treatment, are feeling fuzzy-brained as a result of the chemo or indeed the diagnosis, and trying to manage the anxiety, that stress. How are you measuring the impact? Because, of course, people who have got cancer, who've had cancer treatment, you know, time is tight. They are dealing with a lot of stuff. You want to know that they're using their time wisely.
That's right. So we do some standardised tasks to test people's cognitive function. So we look at what that's like before the group and after the group. And we also ask people to complete some measures about what their brain function is like in everyday life. So, for example, we might be asking them things like, in the last little while, how often have you forgotten the name of somebody that you were talking to or lost the thread of what you were saying in a conversation? So these are all everyday cognitive slip-ups that we can all relate to. And we see whether things like that change.
And
they do. So people who do our groups get better on some of the standard tests. So one that showed up in particular in this study was that their processing speed improved, which could be to do with concentration and attention, but certainly they showed bigger benefit of that with the groups. And also they reported fewer of these cognitive errors in everyday life.
Well, I guess, though, one of the things is that can bring clarity to an experience is sharing it with other people, and that's what you're doing in these workshops. It
yes.
might not actually be what's happening in the workshops, the techniques you're teaching. It might actually just be, the release of being able to talk to other people about the experience.
Yes, potentially, and that's where it's important to have sort of good research design so that we can check that out. But there are other research teams working on this research as well who've had similar findings, and also our latest trial was a randomised trial, so we could compare to people who we tested multiple times but who hadn't yet received the group. And we did find that those who had done the workshops do benefit more. But yes, we certainly need to know what is it specifically that's helping with these workshops, if it is the workshops that are having the benefit.
And where are you going to roll these workshops? Where are they happening so we can tell listeners about it?
So we've been running them at Griffith University on the Gold Coast, and we're actually expanding things a little from now. So I'm in discussions at the moment with the Mater Hospital in Brisbane for people who meet some criteria there. And if that goes ahead, that will be seeing how that runs in a different kind of environment rather than a university. Mm-hmm. And we're also looking at doing them online. And we're really excited about that possibility of opening it up to a broader audience rather than just people who can make the time to come along to a group.
Heather Green, take it global.
We'd love to, but one step at a time, Natasha.
Look, Faye, all the best. Thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us. And Heather Green, thank you for joining us to talk about these workshops.
Thank you, Natasha.
Thank you very much.
Heather Green, lecturer in clinical psychology at Griffith University. Faye Schultz, a participant in one of Heather Green's workshops that we've heard about, helping people really manage the cognitive challenges and difficulties that they can experience during a bout of chemotherapy and other cancer treatments. More information about what Heather's trying to do there on the Life Matters website. Check it out there. Look, you continue to have a fantastic Easter weekend, won't you? It's been great sharing the morning with you here on ABC RN. Don't forget you can tweet us at RN Life Matters. You can email us from our website. You can catch up with the audio there too. You can share stories on social media there, abc.net.au/RN. And look for Life Matters. And our listener feedback line, if you just want to get on the blower right now and give some feedback about something you've heard, that number, as always, 02 833 1430. Bye from us. Stay with the network. Coming up, Books and Arts.